and disgrace. Yet, like others whose path was righteous, he has persevered and has been ultimately vindicated. Two other examples of courageous profiles come to mind. John Adams' legal representation of the British soldiers and their commanding officer, Captain Thomas Preston, in the case historically recorded as the Boston Massacre. On March 5, 1770, close to the Boston Custom House, a British sentry was confronted by an angry mob. Violence ensued, shots were fired, and five in the unruly crowd were killed. Patriots were outraged and sought a public hanging of the loathsome redcoats. No lawyers, except one, would represent the British soldiers. When asked to do so, John Adams accepted. As a result of his challenge of the government's case and ability to penetratingly search for and reveal the truth at trial, the British captain and six of his men were acquitted. Adams chose to honor the principles of a fair trial and render competent counsel to the accused. For so doing, he was publicly vilified. In 1784, Alexander Hamilton chose to represent a Tory in a highly celebrated civil case, Rutgers versus Waddington. The plaintiff, a sympathetic patriotic widow, Elizabeth Rutgers, owned a brewery and alehouse on Maiden Lane, located in the lower portion of Manhattan near Wall Street in New York City. During the British occupation of New York, she abandoned her property in 1776. At the urging of the British, Joshua Waddington ultimately took possession and became its operator. The civil complaint lay in trespass, seeking damages for the fair rental value of the property. During the post-Revolutionary War period, Tories were routinely oppressed. Hamilton's sense of justice was offended. He also believed that the case had legal significance. On June 29, 1784, he argued Waddington's cause in the mayor's court in New York City. At issue was the right of a high appellate court to void a legislative act. Hamilton's legal brilliance carried the day, with the court rendering an opinion favorable enough to Waddington that ultimately resulted in an amicable settlement between the parties. However, the case will long be noted for Hamilton's vision of the doctrine of judicial review, which became the law of the land in 1803, when the U.S. Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice John Marshall, decided Marbury versus Madison. Adams and Hamilton were vilified for choosing to enter the public arena and representing vigorously an extremely unpopular cause. In so doing, they became the predicate to the Mark Lane narrative. These three intrepid advocates have enriched in perpetuity our justice system. All three understood that America would always be special if the strong were just, the weak secure, and the marketplace available and welcome to all. In early 1977, I first met Mark Lane. At the time, I was deputy chief counsel to the Congressional Committee investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. During the course of the investigation, I set aside an afternoon every week to listen to individuals who had information they wished to share with me and the committee. On one such afternoon, Mark Lane came to see me. Before that, I had never met or spoken to him. When he entered the office, I stood to welcome him and asked him to be seated. He refused. Instead, he handed me a sealed envelope. I asked him if he had any suggestions or thoughts about its contents. He said, "When you read the contents, I believe you'll know exactly what to do." Immediately, he left. I never spoke to him again during the course of the investigation and for more than a decade thereafter. The document in the envelope was a memo dated November 23, 1963, from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to all Bureau supervisory personnel. In substance, it stated that the FBI agents who had questioned Lee Harvey Oswald for approximately 17 hours had listened to a tape of a conversation between an individual who identified himself as Lee Oswald and an individual in the Cuban embassy. The conversation had taken place inside the Russian embassy in Mexico City by this faux alleged Oswald who telephoned the Cuban embassy. The call was made on or about October 1, 1963, just about 7 weeks before the assassination. The Hoover memo noted that the agents categorically concluded that the voice on the tape